You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings. Top of the Monday to you, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. This whole Mitt Romney, Bain Capital, where are his tax havens? How much money does he have in Switzerland? How much money does he have in the Caymans? When did he leave Bain, and when did he know that he had left Bain? Now Ed Gillespie coming out over the weekend saying, he left in 2002, 2003, but it was retroactive to 1999. Right. So what does that mean? Retroactive? Thank you, Jim. This is just incredible. I mean, just incredible. There's no other way to say it. Mitt Romney, and by the way, 15 minutes ago, President Obama pointed out that Mitt Romney's tax plan, and by the way, Paul Krugman has a great piece about this in today's New York Times, and, you know, basically, well, back to Mitt Romney's tax plan, that his tax plan will be a huge tax cut for millionaires and billionaires. Now, what Paul Krugman points out is he starts out by saying, you know, you got these nannery nanobs in the Democratic Party and on the so-called left, people like Ed Rendell, saying, you shouldn't be going after Mitt Romney for being a rich businessman. After all, some of my best friends are rich businessmen. I mean, essentially, that's the message, right? Bill Clinton kind of saying the same thing. I'm not sure that that's so seemly. The Clinton Foundation needs some money from these people. Whatever. And Paul Krugman says, that's nonsense. I mean, come on, give me a break. The reason why Romney's riches and where he chooses to put them, you know, which offshore island he puts them in, the reason those are a legitimate public policy debate is because they are meta to public policy. Right? The whole public policy thing is, well, okay, my tax plan gives you a 4.3% deduction and the 4.442, you know, I mean, you get into the numbers and you absolutely get into the weeds of, you know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. And the Republicans and conservatives are so good at this.
Did you know that Obamacare is going to, we're going to see about 22%, 15%.
Bottom line is that Romney's tax plan is to cut taxes on millionaires and billionaires, and Obama's tax plan is to cut taxes on people making under $250,000 and jack up taxes on people making over $250,000. Now, you tell me there's not a starker difference in the world between those two things. But even when you talk about the details of that and that whole $250,000 thing and all that stuff, the media won't touch it. Why? A, they figure if you're talking real numbers, people's eyes glaze over. So we're not going to do that because we program to an average seventh grade mentality. Right? I mean, you know, welcome to network news, number one. And number two, whenever they talk about numbers, the other side comes out and says, oh, those are your numbers. Well, here's my numbers. So if you offer a meta argument, an argument that isn't the actual detailed argument, but is meta to it, you know, is a substitute for it that everybody gets. Like Obama still had student loans when he was in the U.S. Senate, and he was only able to pay them off because his book became a bestseller. And Romney has so many hundreds of millions of dollars that he's got $100 million in a 401k. Figure that one out. He gave $100 million to his sons. Figure that one out. And he's got, in fact, in his disclosure forms, you know, where it said that he was working at Bain Capital, the ones that he filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission under threat of perjury, as in felony if you're lying, in those forms that he filed with the SEC in 2001, he said he was the sole shareholder, in other words, the only owner of Bain Capital. He was the CEO, the chief executive officer of Bain Capital, and that he was the chairman of the board of directors of Bain Capital, and that he earned over $100,000 a year. Now, the SEC requires you to say, and this is a law that this is kind of an archaic law, goes back several decades, back to when $100,000 was big bucks, back, you know, during the Reagan, before the Reagan era, when CEOs typically made 30 times what their workers made, and back in the 70s, you know, $20,000 a year was a good salary. So the CEO might make $150,000, $200,000 a year. So if you made more than $100,000 a year, you had to declare it. Now, it could be $1 million, it could be $5 million, it could be $30 million, it could be $70 million. But what you have to fill in the little form there is over $100,000, and that's what Mitt Romney filled in. And I think that's one of the reasons he's not releasing his tax returns. Because you will see, I predict, you will see that Mitt Romney was paid as the CEO and as the chairman of the board of Bain Capital in 1999, in 2000, in 2001, in 2002, and finally when he sold his share in it, or a chunk of it, in 2003, that he was paid probably tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, that was his cash-in time. And odds are, given, you know, over the last couple of years, given the way that the market crashed, odds are, you know, and that he makes most of his living sitting on his butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail. Therefore, he only pays a maximum 15% income tax, actually 13.9%. But the point is, he's the investor class. He's not the working class. And the investor class has these little cool things. You know, like if you're a working class person and last year you made $30,000, $40,000 at your job, or let's say the year before last, and then last year you lost your job for half the year, and you were on unemployment or you were working part-time at Walmart, and finally you got, you know, even a part-time job, so at the end of the year you only made $12,000, so your income went from $30,000 a year to $12,000 a year. Well, you can't average those things out and say, well, I had a $28,000 loss or an $18,000 loss. Therefore, give me back some of my tax money from the year when I made $30,000. You can't do that. Working class doesn't get to do that. Working class pays up to 35% in taxes. The investor class, the capitalist class, and there's really not that many of them, you know, maybe a couple hundred thousand in this country, maybe not even that, of people who actually are capitalists, people who put money out into investments and all of their income, they live on their investments. The Paris Hilton class. Those people pay a maximum 15% income tax rate because investors are so much important, more important as human beings, after all, though, you know. And so anyhow, Mitt Romney says over 100,000. I'm guessing it's tens of millions, maybe more. His tax returns would show that, which is why he doesn't want to release them. And so anyhow, a couple of minutes ago, President Obama said Romney's tax plan disproportionately helps the wealthy. Yeah, it does. Surprise, surprise. 4 hours ago, top Romney advisor Kevin Madden told NBC News that the calls will never end for Mitt Romney's tax returns. No matter how many years he releases, it won't be enough. Over the weekend, he said, hey, you know, John Kerry only released 2 years. I'm only going to release 2 years. Right. John Kerry released 2 years because the previous 18 years were already on the public record. He'd been a senator all that time. Every year he'd released his tax returns. So there were 20 years of John Kerry's tax returns out there. So that when that gets pointed out to Mitt Romney, he goes, well, his wife never disclosed her, you know, never released her. Well, his wife is independently wealthy. She used to be married to a different senator, Senator Hines. And then he died and, you know, she started sparking with John and they hooked up. But she kept all her money as her money. John was doing fine, thank you very much. And they had separate economic lives. And everybody knew she was rich. But she wasn't running for president of the United States. I haven't heard anybody say that they want to hear Ann Romney's tax returns, and I guarantee you Ann Romney had income too. Well, maybe not, actually, because Mitt Romney took a $70,000 deduction last year for her horse. Can you do that? I can't.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which says either I don't have enough horses, I got none, or he's got too many. Or the tax laws are screwy, you know, on behalf of people like Brownie. Mitt, I'm just a tax return.
Don't love you.
Please release me. This is the song that Mitt's tax return is singing. His tax returns. maybe 5 years, 10 years worth. So pick it up. There you go. Release me. Please release me. Okay. Yeah. At least you're going to hear a lot of varieties of that today. So, you know, is Mitt's fortune bigger than we actually know? There's this little think about it from DemocraticUnderground.com over on DemocraticUnderground.com. Surprise. Is Mitt Romney's fortune even bigger than he claimed? Was his tax rate actually lower than 15%? Did he pay any taxes at all in some years? Are his offshore tax havens in Bermuda, Switzerland, and the Cayman Islands just the tip of the iceberg? Did he invest in companies that ship jobs overseas? Did he lie to the Massachusetts State Ethic Commission about his residency status when filing for governor, which is a felony? And it would also mean that his governorship was illegitimate. Right? I mean, right now, he's trying to tell you and me that he was a resident of Utah working on the Olympics in Salt Lake City in 2002. But he told the state of Massachusetts when he finished up the Olympics, you know, halfway to three quarters of the way through 2002, that he had been a resident of the state for a number of years, therefore he qualified to be governor because he had been flying back and forth to Massachusetts regularly for board meetings. Now he's saying, no, I had no board meetings. And then he told the Security and Exchange Commission that he had a controlling interest in Bain Capital. And now he's saying, oh, I didn't have anything. I didn't control it. And here's the one that's not on this list that I would recommend people start putting it on the list. And that is, where did Mitt Romney vote in 2000 and 2002? Maybe if somebody in the chat room could track this down for me really quickly, I would appreciate it. When did Teddy Kennedy run for re-election and Mitt Romney stayed in Mass, kept his voter registration, bragged about it in the primary so that he could vote against Teddy Kennedy? Was that the 2000 election or the 2002 election? I don't know. But whichever one it was, either one of them would work. Question, did he lie about his residency so that he could vote? So you've got financial fraud, you got voter fraud, you've got, you know, concealing from the American people. I mean, what is going on with this guy? Bill Kristol, the guy who wanted the war in Iraq and the war with Afghanistan, now wants a war with Iran. He's asking for Mitt Romney to please release his tax returns. It was 2000. Thank you. Shane just checked this out. It was, oh, and Fritz DeCat throws it in the chat room. It was the 2000 election. So Romney goes to Salt Lake City in 1999, and he's so gone that he can't even show up in Boston for a meeting with Bain Capital, but he votes in Boston in 2000, presumably by absentee ballot. I don't know. Maybe that's legal. I'm surprised nobody's asking that question, frankly. But this all started with this Boston Globe thing on Thursday. Yesterday, Ed Gillespie comes out and he says, oh, you know, it's the 2 years, it's the standard that John Kerry did. No. And now they're saying, oh, well, he retroactively quit. Right? In 2002 or 2003, he quit in 1999. I'm not making this up. This is what I believe it was Ed Gillespie. It was one of his guys was on one of the Sunday shows, and he said, oh, he retroactively resigned. Right. This is not going to go away. This is only going to get stickier and stickier. And I'm wondering how many others are wondering whether he's going to make it to Tampa. And if not, who are the Republicans going to put in to replace him? I mean, should Chris Christie and Tim Pawlenty and Bobby Jindal and Nikki Haley and all the whole bunch of them, Sarah Palin, should they all, apparently she tried to get him last week or said something to the effect that caused some people to think that she was finagling around for a VP spot. And by the way, we just learned that Mitt Romney gave 20 years of tax returns to John McCain. Now, this is a media report. I don't I can't attest its veracity, but I've seen it repeated in several places, that he gave 20 years of tax returns to John McCain. John McCain took one look at them and picked Sarah Palin. Now, that should tell you something, right? So anyhow, I would say to all those people who are, you know, that long line, what was it, 12 dwarfs, Snow White and the seven dwarfs, yeah. I would say to all of them, I'm not sure you could call Chris Christie a dwarf, but in any case, I would say to all of them, maybe you should seriously stop thinking about trying to be Mitt Romney's vice president, Ron Paul, another one, and instead think about going to Tampa and running for president. I mean, there may be an open space there. I'm waiting to hit Intrade one of these days, and probably, you know, somebody should start this as a bet. You go over to Intrade.com, it's this Irish betting site, and they're almost always spot on about American politics, because you got a lot of Americans who are over there betting on politics, and they're well-informed people. And, you know, the good money right now is on Rob Portman and Pawlenty, Tim Pawlenty as vice president, but I'm waiting for somebody to put one up that says Mitt Romney will not be the party's nominee. I mean, we've still got a few weeks here. Is it possible that Mitt Romney won't be his own party's nominee because he is just like so badly, he has trashed himself? I mean, the question that George Will asked over the weekend, and I think this was just like brilliant, was the words to the effect of, the day John McCain lost the election, November 2008, Mitt Romney knew he was going to run 4 years later. He should have released everything the next day. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
All of that, by the way, is really only half of the whole thing. I want to get into what conservatives are all about and why anybody would call him a conservative, too.
Challenge a man who has all of the money, all of the money, yeah. You're so vain.
Vain!
You think that you can buy the White House. You're so vain.
Yes, Mr.
You
Romney.
Think that you can buy the White House.
Bring it up, bring it up here. Yeah, there we go. You know, I used to be a DJ. I should have a pod in here to control my own audio. I am so used to talking over music. You know, although it used to be you never talked over the vocals. You know, okay, this record has a 37-second intro, time a 36-second rant. I'm going to get to your calls in just a second. This is, after all, a talk show. But one last point I want to make, and it'll just take a minute or two, and then I'm going to, you know, put you on the air. And that is that people say, well, you know, what's the big deal? What if he lied on a disclosure form about hundreds of millions of dollars? Or what if he lied about whether or not he was a legal voter in that state? Or, yeah, I mean, so what? Lies are not that big a deal. Everybody tells lies, right? I have two words to answer that question. Bill Clinton. Or maybe I should say Monica Lewinsky. Or maybe I should say, remember Orrin Hatch saying, it's not about the sex, it's about the lie. They impeached a sitting president over lying under oath. Had Bill Clinton not been under oath, and had the word is had a slightly different meaning, he never would have been impeached. He was successfully impeached in the House of Representatives. He was not removed from office in the Senate, but just by the skin of his teeth. But the Republicans impeached a sitting president over simply telling a lie to cover up sex. And somehow that's a far more horrible thing in Republican world than lying to cover up hundreds of millions of dollars. $100 million in your 401k. $100 million here, $100 million there. I mean, come on. It's just Lynn in Chicago. Hey, Lynn, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Tom. Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to you talking about Romney not releasing his tax records except for, I believe it was the 2010
year.
And I believe he made $45 million that year.
I don't have the numbers. My recollection was it was in the 20s, $23 million, something like that.
Okay. I was telling your producer, my family's income last year, and I'm not bragging, was $2.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And when my husband did our taxes this year, we paid $800,000 federal. And by the time you factor in the state and everything else, we paid over $800,000 in taxes, which was fine. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah, I'm guessing. I'm guessing.
We have plenty to live on.
Yeah, I'm guessing that most of your multimillion-dollar income last year was salary as opposed to investment income.
Exactly, and I don't understand.
So you work for a living. You're well paid, but you work for a living.
We're well paid working stiffs, I guess is how you could put it.
Well, that's fine. I mean, that's the same thing as that is true of, you know, the surgeon who did Louise's breast cancer surgery. He probably makes $1 million a year. God bless him. But I'll tell you, he's paying 35% income tax, and Mitt Romney is paying 15% income tax because, after all, investment bankers are so much more important to society.
Well, exactly. And, you know, the thing is, the Republicans want to say they're patriotic and how much they love their country and how much they love the military, and they don't want to pay for anything.
Yeah.
And they dodge the taxes as much as they can. And I don't see where it's patriotic not to do your share.
Amen. Well
and
said.
One more thing, Tom. If you were playing the clips of FDR, I know you did it last week and you did it a few weeks ago, and I tried to call in. Your line was busy.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to hear you, instead of just calling them the banksters and the fat cats, start using the term economic royalists.
Sure.
FDR had it right. it was true in his time, and it's absolutely true today.
Lynn, hang on the line and listen. Just for you, here you go.
Thank you.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power, and our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
And Lynn, he did it. You know, he did it. So.
And I'd love Obama to start
talking
a
like
more
that.
FDR.
Yeah, there you go. He needs. Well, he's getting there. He's getting there.
Yes, he really is, and I'm so happy to see it. And,
yes.
You know, I wish that he, the last 3 years, fought a little harder instead of trying to work with them. And I was listening to Stephanie Miller this morning, and she had somebody on who said working with Republicans is like trying to put a sweater on a 3-year-old who doesn't want to get dressed.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good metaphor. Lynn, I've got to move along, but thank you for your kind call and for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom, and all the best to Louise.
Thank you. I'll pass that on. I think she just heard you. Thank you very much. It's really quite remarkable, isn't it? Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Listen, first of all, to the Ed Rendells, to the Cory Bookers, to the Harold Ford Jr.
Well, I think Corey has walked back that, although Harold Ford Jr. is still there, yeah.
Well, I have a message for all those Hillary Clinton Democrats. Nah, 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 nah. It worked. I know it's childish, but it worked. Go away. Come back in 2016, and we'll support your candidate. But for right now, we only have one president at a time.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
And then for Mitt Romney, listen, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell me as an American citizen, I know how to make things work. I created 100,000 jobs. When you're taking credit for things that happened after you, quote unquote, left Bain, but you don't want to take blame for the outsourcing of jobs at the same time. I don't care how hard I tried. Me and my son can't occupy the same space that I'm standing in at the same time. You can't
Carl, here, this may be the solution. You know, the Republicans are very anti-science, and you know, it's kind of Newton's laws of thermodynamics, or maybe Aristotle's postulation of the atom, but basically somewhere along there in that multi-thousand year arc of science, we came up with the idea that you can't be in two places at once. And, you know, Republicans deny science, and so maybe Mitt Romney thinks he can be.
Yeah, I mean, that, and then, you know, to me,
you never
the
know.
Question, I think that that's the question that needs to be asked. Are, if you're going to, hey, these Supreme Staples and Sports Authority and those guys making all these jobs, but you weren't there. But,
yeah.
But here's the thing. Another thing, I'm like, I can't walk around, tell people my name is Carl Davis, but then on my driver's license, it says Carl Stevens. Well, I'm one of the others. So SEC forms don't lie.
Yeah.
You were the CEO. You were the man in charge. And on top of that, you laid a culture of the way things are done. Things don't change away from the way things are done to a brand new system.
Yeah, not when you own 100% of it over the next couple of years. Absolutely right, Carl. Thank you very much. Lee in Chicago. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hi. You know what? I looked into Romney's Sankity Advisors that is managed by Bain Capital.
Sankity is one of his investment firms, right?
Yeah,
one of his funds.
It's a wholly owned corporation in Bermuda.
Yeah.
Wholly owned by Mitt Romney.
Right.
But Bain Capital's website says Sankity manages credit default swaps collateralized debt obligations.
And CDOs.
Right,
which is the stuff that crashed our economy in 2008.
Exactly. They made a fortune on the housing crash. And if you look at 2007, 2008, 2009, that's why he can't show his tax returns, because he can't explain that he bet against the American people.
I'll bet you're right. Thanks a lot, Lee, for the call. Brenda in Saginaw, Michigan. Hey, Brenda, what's up?
Hey, we think that he learned everything from his father.
Mm-hmm.
When his father was governor here in Michigan, his father gave tax breaks to GM and Ford.
Right.
Well, we believe that he got kickbacks from the auto industry.
Well, he used to be the chairman of American Motors, you know, the old Rambler company.
Yeah, but we think he hid the money in Mitt's name in bank accounts. Back then, you didn't have to account for your kids' accounts.
Right. Like, okay. I got it. Brenda, thank you for that. Don't know. Can't verify it. Frank in Folsom, California. Hey, Frank, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. My question is, Mitt Romney, the last report I heard that he gave 16% of his income to the Mormon Church. And my question is there a limit? And if you know, how much can you donate to a church, and is it considered a business?
To the best of my knowledge, there's no limit on how much you can give and deduct from your income taxes. And although I could be wrong, I don't represent myself as a tax guy. You know, I can't figure out my own taxes. But I don't think I'm on the board of a charity, and I'm I don't know. But to the best of my knowledge, no, there's not a limit. And it should all be deductible. And what was the other question?
Well, you know, because the Mormon Church is quite
is it a business?
A lot of business.
Right, yeah. No, the Mormon Church is fully tax deductible. And that's where, you know, I'm of the opinion, frankly, that outside of monasteries, all churches should be taxable, taxed just like everybody else. Thanks a lot, Frank, for the call, including the Mormon Church.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now, it doesn't win me a lot of friends with church people, but, hey, you know, it's what I think. I'm all in favor of monasteries, though, being tax-free. Oh, please release those tax returns, Mitt. Yeah, well, tax returns need protection. Well, tax returns should fall on the table. Here, let's take a look. I don't think so. Mitt's got those things hidden. Oh, that's what he did. He threw them over the wall. Yeah. I shall be released. Welcome back, Tom Hartman. Why doesn't he return his tax? Release his tax returns. John in Oak Park, Illinois. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hi. I'm a small businessman, mom and pop store, 117 years in an office supply area, and one of the few small guys left. And I was just tossing out the other side of the coin. Everyone gives a lot of kudos to Romney for Staples' success and the jobs it's created. But the other side of the coin is that so many mom-and-pop stores in so many towns went out of business because of the big box stores that he brought in. And all of those monies were all back locally in the community. And God right. knows where the Staples money is going.
Well, it went to Boston. I mean, that's it went to Mitt Romney. And yeah. and you're absolutely right. I mean, Staples is the Walmart of the office supply business. They open up stores and smaller mom and pop shops like yours close. And I defy you to go into Staples and find something made in the United States, other than maybe a paper product. I mean, you know, we got a lot of trees, but, you know, anything seriously manufactured. Well said. John, thank you very much. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. James in Seattle. Hey, James, next Saturday I'll be in Seattle.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to go see you.
Oh, it's going to be a hoot. Yeah.
So what I was calling about is my wife's a physician. She's an extremely educated physician, and I work in the software industry for a large software company here in the Seattle area.
Mm-hmm.
And between the two of us, we make $600,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty good income.
Because, yeah, it's fantastic. Granted, the vast majority of that is my wife, but we pay about 30-35% in taxes.
Oh, because you're actually earning that money. You're a worker.
Right.
You're a maker, not a taker like Romney. So Paris Hilton or Mitt Romney and you made that $600,000 sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you would pay a maximum 15% income tax rate. But because you work for a living, you're paying 35%.
Exactly. And we pay a buttload of taxes every year, but I am happy to go ahead and do it. My wife, not so much.
I understand.
But my point to her is always, we have a better economy, we pay more taxes, we have a better economy, you're going to get patients with more health care, ultimately make more
money. Here's the ultimate story, I think, and this is the story that this German businessman who was being interviewed on, as I recall, Bloomberg, one of the shows that they run out of Singapore, and this American reporter was asking him about his income tax. And, you know, the
right.
guy, he was there to talk about income or business. And the reporter said, you know, how much do you pay in income taxes? And the guy said, I think around 54%. And the reporter was like, that's incredible. That's horrible. I can't believe it. And the guy said, that's all right. And then, you know, a few minutes later, he came back to the thing and he says, you really pay 54% income tax? And the guy said, yeah. And then the third time he asked him, finally, the businessman said, the reporter said, why wouldn't you move to a low tax country? Why would you tolerate, you know, paying that level of taxes? And the fellow said, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country.
Right. And a complete different aside, I used to have the misfortune to live in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mormons typically are required to tithe 15%. Romney is a bishop. But a bishop is essentially the equivalent of your neighborhood priest in a church.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you for clearing that up. Shane tracked it down, and he said it was 10% over what you need, 10% of the surplus over what you need, which might functionally work out to like 15% or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Kevin in Boulder City, Nevada. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom? I'm a new caller.
I enjoy
your show so far. It's beautiful. And I'd like to just bring up the fact that, you know, in any other situation, if we had people, Republican Congress, trying to stop everything good for the country,
mm-hmm.
what would we do? If that was in your family, if that was in a business, we would say, hey, you know, are you American?
Yeah.
Are you thinking about your country? Do you really love your country? If the people, the blue collar, like myself, are just trying to make ends meet, and my millions and millions, all that's those figures, you know.
Yeah.
What solution is there?
Yeah. Well, this
I would say they're almost like terrorists to me, because if you're hurting this country, the country I love, then you shouldn't be there.
Yeah. Well, or at least you shouldn't be there in political office. Kevin, I don't disagree with you. And this is, and thank you for the call. January 20th, 2009, 14 Republican leaders from Congress got together. Now, this was January 20th was the day that Obama was inaugurated. I was here in Washington, D.C. We did our show live from the portico, the second floor of the U.S. Capitol building. I was 35 or 40 feet away from him as he raised his hand and took the oath of office. Ellen Ratner and I were the closest reporters to President Obama, or among the four or five closest reporters. It was an amazing experience. 5 or 6 hours later, in a restaurant called the Caucus Room, which ironically was on the backside of the building that Louise and I lived in for a year in, here in Washington, D.C. when we first moved here. It was down on D and 9th Street. This fancy steakhouse, very expensive, fancy schmancy. It's where all the lobbyists go to eat. This group of Republicans, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, Newt Gingrich, and Frank Luntz got together the night that Obama was inaugurated in the Caucus Room restaurant and basically swore a blood oath to do everything they could to bring down his presidency. In fact, what Newt Gingrich said as they were leaving the meeting was, let me find it here. Hang on just a second. You will remember this day. Oh, not as the day we became traitors. He said, you'll remember this day as the day the seeds of 2012 were sown.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Christopher Markowski is on the line with us. He is the CEO of Markowski Investments and host of the nationally syndicated radio show, The Watchdog on Wall Street, watchdogonwallstreet.com, the website. Christopher, welcome.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I am fine. Thanks for joining us. You wrote this piece called Socialized Europe, Try Socialized America. You want to give us the elevator speech on it?
Well, yeah, it's just we're heading down, in my opinion, and it's not in everybody's opinion, absolutely the wrong path in the size of the government that we have. And you're taking a look at what's transpiring over in Europe. And, you know, I'm one that spent a lot of time there, has a lot of family over there, and it's imploding. And
well, actually, it's not.
What's that?
Actually, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
Europe is a big place. You know, Germany has arguably one of the best economies in the world, and they're the largest country in Europe. France is doing fairly well.
If you take a look at their books, okay, and you actually take a look at the amount of money that they owe, they are imploding. And Germany is very, very frightened at the fact that they're going to have to start bailing out all these other
countries. That's just because of the euro.
I have family in Italy, and I have family in Greece.
Yeah, well, those are the weak sisters. But, you know, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway, Germany, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, they're all doing fine, thank you very much.
They want out of the euro because the entire system and the way that the thing was set up in the sense that...
Well, they should get out of the euro, but we don't have a euro problem here. We control our own currency. So why do you think that we're going to go down the same road? Or are you advocating each state should be able to issue their own currency or we should go back to the Civil War?
Once you keep printing and printing and printing, eventually, just like it happened in Greece, I mean, Greece was borrowing money at the same rates that the Germans were borrowing money.
No, not quite so much. Greece set up that scam with Goldman Sachs in order to get into the euro. Based on the drachma, and Goldman Sachs phony baloney the books.
When you take a look at our numbers, and you take a look at our books, and you see that the amount of money that we're going to owe, do you think that we're going to be able to borrow money at these rates forever? I mean,
they're
freaking out in Italy right now because their borrowing rates just went back to the 20-year mean.
We're the largest economy in the world. We own our own currency. We've got, you know, net wealth in the hundreds of trillions of dollars in this country. Absolutely. I mean, Japan right now has a debt to GDP ratio of over 200%. Ours isn't even 100%.
We should just keep printing more?
I am not suggesting, you know, the frame of that question is preposterous. We are not existing by printing money. When you borrow
60% of our debt last year was bought by the Federal Reserve.
Great. We own our own debt. I mean, that's why Japan is able to sustain their debt. They own virtually all of it.
Tom, if you were to run something like that on your own, they'd put you in jail.
I'm not a country.
Does it make any difference?
No, it does make a difference because the rules for a business and the rules for a family are not the same as the rules for a country.
Eventually, you're going to hit a wall. You can't do it forever. Once people
no, of course not. This is why President Obama wants to raise taxes on rich people.
And people, when they're going to stop believing after a certain period of time, you know, that's when you're going to have a big implosion. That's
this is
what happens.
This is not the confidence fairy, Christopher.
This is
not the confidence fairy. This is real world economics, number one. And number two, President Obama is saying, yeah, let's do something about this. You've got three Republican presidents who ran up more debt. Actually, Ronald Reagan ran up more debt than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. He tripled our national debt. Nobody ever done that in the history of this country. And then George Herbert Walker Bush added another $2 trillion to it, took us up to $5 trillion. And then George W. Bush added another $5 trillion to it. Two unfunded wars, Medicare demand that you can't negotiate the drugs, and this huge tax cut for millionaires and billionaires, which led to
Obama added another $5 trillion as well. Okay, so they're all responsible.
Which led to a situation where Obama found himself in the middle of a disaster. And now he's trying to walk back those tax breaks. And guys like you are saying, oh, no, let's not stop the taxes.
The Buffett tax will raise $5 billion. $5 billion a year.
That's nonsense.
So if we balance, yes, it is true. If we balance,
that is absolute nonsense.
Yes, it is. If we balance our budget, it will take 500 years to pay off our national debt. 500 years. Listen, I'm all for it. You want to raise taxes? Let's cut a deal. This is how we go about raising taxes in this country. We balance the budget. We put it into the Constitution where we cannot spend more than we take in. Then we go to the American
people. Oh, that's really brilliant. Have you ever read the history of World War II or the Civil War?
What's that?
Have you ever read the history of World War II or the Civil War, the fiscal history?
And obviously, that's a war type.
Do you know what our GDP was? Our debt to GDP ratio was at the end of World War II?
Do you think that we're going to have the type of influx in regards to people coming into this
country? No, just a very simple question, Chris. Do you know what our debt to GDP ratio was at the end of World War II?
And England's was too, and England never recovered. I mean,
what was our debt to GDP ratio? Very simple question, Chris. What was our debt to GDP ratio at the end of World War II?
I don't know.
It was 127%.
Okay.
We were wildly in debt. Now here's the question. How did we pay that off?
We grew our economy.
Right. And how did we grow our economy? What did Eisenhower do? He borrowed more money. He built a national highway system. He put millions of young people through school.
We're going to borrow another $1 trillion, and we're going to spend it on what?
We've got a $2 trillion infrastructure debt. Are you going to ask a question and not let me finish a sentence?
This doesn't work that way. Okay,
it does work that way. Dwight Eisenhower proved it works that way. And he was a Republican.
No, he had a huge technological revolution over these past several decades that has brought growth, and we've had ups and we have downs. But to think that we're going to be able
no, we have not. We had three consecutive decades after Eisenhower started this, the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s, where we had GDP growth of over 3.2% per decade, the first time in the history of the United States, arguably the first time in the history of the world, and it was because they were investing in America.
The last couple of years,
and you want to say stop investing in America?
We got to spend more. I'm not saying to stop. I say invest more in America. Okay.
So you want to make up that $2 trillion infrastructure deficit we've had since Reagan stopped building roads? Chris, you're not even you. I don't get it. You want to have a conversation, but I'm not allowed to finish a sentence.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I think you were talking.
Go ahead.
So how are you going to? So you don't want to make up. Ronald Reagan stopped spending money on schools, on roads, on hospitals, on airports. Basically, we stopped our whole infrastructure. You look at the bullet trains in France. You look at the trains in Germany. You look at the trains in Japan. You look at the trains in China. They're all these sleek, modern things. What do we have? Amtrak.
Yeah.
You don't want to put a penny into Amtrak, do you?
Spain, too. They're working real well. I mean, that's what we need. We need more ideas that lose money. I mean, come on. If the trains would work, the private sector would fund it. It's just that simple. The private sector would fund it if it
Chris, do you know who funded the trains in the 1880s?
In Orlando, which is an 80-mile trip.
Chris, do you know who funded the trains in the 1880s? That built the American Revolution, the Industrial Revolution in the United States?
Choo-choo trains.
It was Abraham Lincoln. He gave $2 trillion in today's money to five guys. Jay Gould, Samuelson.
Structure from the 1800s and what we had to do to move goods and services across this country to today.
So let's build a modern transportation infrastructure.
To get on these bullet trains. The only place where it could actually work in this country is in the is in the New York, Washington, D.C. area, all the way from Boston, New York, Washington. That's the only place where we have the population where it would make that grow. We're running trains.
Then why is it that China just finished building a high-speed rail system, the equivalent of Chicago to New York? It took them 5 years. And with that infrastructure, they are now eating our lunch. They're opening industrial manufacturing sectors all the way in from our equivalent of New York, Shanghai, all the way into their equivalent of Chicago. I forget the name of the interior city. It is rocking. Their economy is growing at 8% a year. It was growing at 10%.
Where were they coming from just a couple decades ago? I mean, come on already. I mean, you can't make...
They couldn't have done this if they had listened to their conservatives who are saying we can't spend money on this.
You want to emulate China? I don't. I most certainly don't want to do what they're doing over there. Come on already. You've seen the...
So you don't want to build infrastructure in the United States. You don't want the United States. You know, in 3 years, China's going to be the number one economy in the world.
Good, but that's not bad. That's a good thing. They have over a billion people, for crying
out. So you want to emulate China?
Huh?
So you think we should emulate China?
No, we shouldn't emulate China, but we should hope that they grow. They've got all these people there. That's great. We want all these countries
to grow. So it's great when they grow, but you don't want to grow.
You don't grow, okay? You're not going to grow this country by the government picking and choosing and spending. They don't do a good job of it.
I would disagree strongly. Chris Markowski, you can read all about it at watchdogonwallstreet.com. Thank you, Chris.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, I would say simply go back and look at, you know, what we did after World War I, what we did after World War II, what we did after the Civil War. Look at how we have built this country.
Please release me, let me go.
I'm a Mitt Romney tax return. Please release me.
For I...
Maybe Mitt doesn't love his tax returns anymore. Maybe he should just let them go, right? Anyway, it's you get the idea. Fred in Malta, Illinois. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Yes, I think most Americans have computers. If they would go online and look up President Harding, who was followed by Grover Cleveland, and who was followed by Herbert Hoover.
Yep, 1920
and look to 1933. Economic policies.
Well, here's one thing to look at beyond that. Do you know what the slogan was that President Harding ran on when he ran for president?
Yeah.
More business, less government in business, more business in government.
Right. And they were giving tax breaks to the wealthy to the large businesses.
That's right. Harding came into office in 1920. He was elected in 20. He was sworn in March of 21. And 6 months later, he dropped the top income tax rate from 91% or 95%, whatever it was, post-World War I, down to 25%. And boom, you got a bubble.
Right. And then remember what took place October 31st, 1929.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And then turn around and take a look at the economic policy of Ronald Reagan and both the Bushes.
Yep. And it's the same. It's the same policy.
Same exact thing.
The Republicans have not changed since the days of Harding and Coolidge and Hoover. You're absolutely right.
If it wasn't for the safety nets that Roosevelt put in, we'd have a crash today.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, I would say that a large part of what contributed to the crash was pulling out one of those structural supports that FDR put into place, 1935 Glass-Steagall Act, which separated gambling banks from passbook savings account and checking account banks. And you're absolutely right. Fred, well said. Thank you. Tony in Stafford, Virginia. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Yeah, I was listening to that caller you had on there, and he was blaming about the deficit and all that.
Yeah.
And it seems strange to me that you don't hear people like that complain about deficit when Republicans have the presidency.
Well, that's because
during the Reagan years, they're spending on deficit.
Oh, sure.
Bush years, same thing.
Sure.
And as soon as Democrats like Clinton and Obama gets in there, that's all you hear. They're running up the deficit.
Yep.
Why?
Google Jude Winiski, Two Santa Claus Theory. And if you Google Tom Hartman as well, you will find several articles that I wrote about this back in the early 2000s. And I was just screaming at Democrats saying, you guys just need to read the historical record. Back in the late 70s, when the Republican Party was in absolute screaming tatters, you know, a decade earlier, Barry Goldwater had gone down in flames in 64, then Richard Nixon in 73 went down in flames. there were, you know, Republicans like my dad who were convinced that the party was never going to recover itself, right? The Republican Party was just in flames. And in 70, I think it was 76, 77, Jude Winiski wrote this article for the Wall Street Journal and made this proposal to the Republicans. He said, here's how you can get back political power. It's very simple. It's a long-term strategy. But he said, the big problem is that ever since the beginning of the 20th century, the Democratic Party, or particularly since the Great Depression, let's say, the Democratic Party has been the party of Santa Claus. They have said to the people, we'll be Santa Claus. We'll give you Social Security. We'll be Santa Claus. We'll give you unemployment insurance. We'll give you Santa Claus. We'll be Santa Claus. We'll give you a 40-hour work week. And the Republicans always were the Grinch, right? The Republicans were always saying, no, 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 no. And he said, we've got to reverse that dynamic. We've got to turn Republicans into Santa Claus. And here's the double jujitsu. We've got to, the second Santa Claus, we've got to force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus, to shoot their Santa Claus. So how do you do that? And he lays this out. I mean, this is no secret. He laid this out, and this has been the Republican game plan ever since the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, and he totally embraced this. And that is that when a Republican is in office, you run up as much debt as possible, as fast as possible. You spend that money like crazy. It'll make the economy look good. I used to, back during the Reagan years, people would say, hey, you know, Reagan's making the economy look pretty good. And I'd say, you give me a $3 trillion credit card, I'll show you what it looks like to live high. All right? I mean, you know, anybody can look like they're living good on a giant credit card. And that's basically what Reagan did. So anyhow, during Republican presidencies, run up the credit card, run up the debt, and as soon as a Democrat comes into office, because it does go back and forth and back and forth, that's a cycle that's impossible to avoid, as soon as a Democrat comes into office, starts screaming about the debt, so loud that the media and everybody obsesses about it, so that the Democrats will be forced to do things to cut back on the debt, and you have put into place structural expenses, and Medicare Part D is a classic example of this, forbidding the government from negotiating drug prices, or having a war, right? Another great example, you know, Bush's two wars. Yeah. You put into place structural expenses that the Democrats can't undo, so they're forced to shoot Santa Claus. In this case, you know, just a few months ago, when John Boehner threatened to, you know, basically blow up the economy, the deal was that they would not cut a budget deal with Obama unless Obama cut unemployment benefits from 99 weeks back to 74 weeks. Obama had to shoot Santa Claus, and he did. I mean, he had no choice. And this has been the Republican strategy all along. When a Democrat comes into office, you scream about the debt. When a Republican's in office, you run that debt up as high and as hard as possible. And eventually, and it has worked. Jude Winiski's theory has worked. You've had Bill Clinton came along and said, you know, we're going to end welfare as we know it, right? He shot the Santa Claus that Lyndon Johnson put into place that created an African-American middle class to a large extent and created a middle class in many areas that had previously been just horrible pockets of poverty, Appalachia, Mississippi, places like this around the world. That middle class, you know, or the beginning, the bootstraps to get into the middle class that LBJ had put into place, you know, Bill Clinton took away to some extent. And this is the whole Republican plan.
But I got one other point here. It just seems like the Republicans, they got this long-range plan.
Yeah, I just laid it out for you.
Now, but then when push comes to shove, the Democrats, they see all this happening, all these fires, and they're trying to put out the fires. And they ain't got time to make a long-range plan.
Right. Well, part of the problem is that the Democrats are always asking the question, what's best for the country? And the Republicans are always asking the question, what's best for the party? And those are very often very different things. In fact, in most cases, what's best for the party is not necessarily what's best for the country. And tragically, that has been the dynamic that has been played out ever since Jude Winiski first published that piece in the Wall Street Journal.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
By the way, in the next hour, we're going to get into some detail about what is a... Why would anybody call themselves a conservative, given the history I'm going to share with you? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Jeff Merkley, representing the great state of Oregon, is on the line with us. Merkley, MERKLEY.senate.gov is his website. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Great to have you here. You are working on the Disclose Act. Tell me about this.
Well, this is the basic principle that when large donations occur, everyone should have a right to know where the money's coming from. It's straightforward. It's the best, nearest available response to Citizens United. And I hope we can pass it tonight.
Well, here's a question I have. The Republicans seem to be all over this. If you're going to vote, you've got to show an ID thing. You know, we're both familiar with that. Why would they, if there's so much all about knowing who the voters are and having people show ID, why is it that if you're going to spend thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars on an election, they don't want to see your ID?
Well, it's changed so much. Just a few years ago, they were saying, we think there should be unlimited donations, but full disclosure, unlimited disclosure. Well, they got the unlimited money out of Citizens United, and suddenly disclosure, they're the 180-degree U-turn.
Yeah.
And it's clear. They looked at the fact that the vast bulk of that money is coming into their coffers and said, well, so much for principle. We're gonna seize the moment here and not let people know where it's coming from.
Well, not only that, they already have law on their side in a partisan fashion, in as much as in 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act required all unions to disclose any of their political activities in full to the Department of Labor as a public document. So any union expenditures are already fully divulged, but corporations now, since Citizens United, they you know, can play in the same playing field, but corporations don't have to and billionaires don't have to divulge this stuff.
No, it's a great point, because there's really the two sides here. There's the donations into the independent expenditures, and there's the actual activity itself. And really, both are sheltered on the corporate side right now.
Right, and the activity on the union side is not.
When you think about it, here is the company boardroom. I keep going back to this number that scares me. I think about Exxon in 2008. If they'd spent 3% of their net profits, they would have spent as much money on the presidential campaign as the rest of America put together.
Wow.
That's the type of vast wealth that can buy these elections and run our republic.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, kiss America goodbye. That is not the kind of America that the founders envisioned. So tell me about the politics of this. How do you expect this to go down in the Senate? I know that a Disclose Act was passed out of the House a couple of years ago successfully, made it to the Senate, got more than 50 votes. So according to the Constitution, it should have become law. But because of the filibuster, it never actually got a vote.
Yes, we got 59 votes twice to shut down debate and get to a final vote. We were one vote short. We needed one Republican to cross the aisle,
right?
One profile in Courage, and we didn't get it. And I think maybe we'll see a couple folks cross the boundary tonight, but probably not the 60 total that we need.
Do you think that this would be worth Harry Reid pulling the nuclear option? Is it time to end the filibuster?
Well, it's certainly time to turn this into a talking filibuster that I think we should be on this a few weeks and let the American people really see where the obstacle is coming from here. And at any moment that there isn't someone on the floor who wants to speak to it, we automatically go to a final vote. And that there is the potential of doing that under our rules, but we'd have to sit down and be engaged in it for a couple weeks and have the citizens turn out in a grassroots fashion and say this really matters.
Right.
One of the things that I'm wrestling with right now is that in many ways our grassroots groups are saying, well, you know, this is the Disclose Act, that's a little bit light. What we really want is a constitutional amendment. And I understand where they're coming from.
Sure.
But this would help build momentum if we could have some massive protests shining a light in the darkness on where the money's coming from and build the momentum into a force. We might have a shot at that constitutional amendment, but
sure.
But right now we don't.
Yeah, you very often in politics you take steps. I mean, you know, we didn't go from the end of slavery to the Civil Rights Act in 1 year. Unfortunately, tragically, but it does take time. And
you know, I find this is an issue that resonates so much in my town halls. I've done 140 of them since I was elected.
Mm-hmm.
And when people understand that the first three words of our Constitution, we the people, are being crossed out and replaced with we the most powerful, it pretty much makes them upset whether they're coming from the right or left.
Yeah. And actually, this is one of the rare issues on which I regularly debate Tea Partiers on this program, and the ones who are not partisan Republicans. I mean, the partisan Republicans, you know, they're just all over. You know, let Karl Rove have all the secret money, and he'll make sure I get reelected. But the Tea Party folks who are more ideologically whatever, libertarian or whatever, they have no problem with that disclosure.
Well, one of the things I like to note is that our forefathers wrote We the People in font that was about eight times the rest of the Constitution,
yep.
Just to remind the Supreme Court and remind the people what this is all about.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, five justices on the Supreme Court didn't seem to pay attention.
Yeah, I would agree. And so does the dissent, Mr. Stevens, or Justice Stevens' brilliant dissent in Citizens United. Senator Jeff Merkley, what the last question here, what can we do? What can our viewers and listeners do right now to help this
pass? Well, one thing you can do is sign the petition. We've had a 250,000 signed in the last few days. I've got it on my website at jeffmerkley.com.
Okay.
So that's one way to access it. But it's and quite frankly, I mean, I wish tonight, when we were in all night tonight, I wish we had a few thousand people outside shining lights in the darkness to accentuate this, but we're going to have a grassroots movement that says we've got to shine light on these vast pools of dark money.
Right. And I would assume one other thing people could do is call their member of Congress.
Absolutely. Call, right, show up at their town halls.
Right. There you go. Okay. Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon, thank you so much for being with us, Senator.
Thank you, Tom.
And I wish you the very best. You're one of the good guys. Thank you. 41 minutes past the hour. It is... it's a truly remarkable time. I mean, it's just genuinely a remarkable time in America. Brian in Madison, Ohio. Hey, Brian, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks, Tom. I hope you're having a great day.
I am. Thank you.
The idiocracy of both the Republican Party and the DNC chairman, he should be fired because we have got to get out there as Democrats and get the message to where this debt has come from.
Okay, I think it's a DNC chairwoman. I think it's Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but I could be wrong. I'm pretty sure she's
there. She should definitely be fired because this has to be brought up because the debt that has accrued in the past, most of the money was for defense, and then, you know, they didn't do anything to help the average man. And I actually was a Republican at the time when they decided the corporation was
a person.
Was a person, yeah. I mean, that's ridiculous. And I changed parties. I got smart, got wise.
Yeah.
And I just don't we need to get out what we need to do, and that is take care of America first. You know, we have so many important parts for all our weapon systems that we have built in China and other foreign countries. If we make them mad at us, we don't get the weapons that our men and women need. We need to bring all of that back and get our manufacturing back.
I'm totally with you, Brian. We've lost much of our strategic infrastructure. Thank you very much for the call. Stephen in Gainesville, Florida, listening on 88.5 FM. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Before I get to my question with you, I want to – you know, nobody ever talks about your books on ADD.
Mm-hmm.
And those books, like, saved my brother's life, man.
He actually
works for NASA now. Mm-hmm. They had him, like, a grade back in reading and stuff like that. And I just wish that more people knew about your books on ADD. And I don't think that gets mentioned enough. So I just want to kind of plug that for you.
Well, thank you.
Yep. And what I called about Citizen United and what I call the election industrial complex now that we're seeing form.
There you go.
It is... I just was reading a story the other day about how the Koch brothers alone, just two people, are spending more than what John McCain raised in his entire presidential election, right?
Wow.
Like over $400 million, right? Because John McCain only raised like $370 million. The Koch brothers are now spending over $400 million. But anyway, so my question to you is, when we see, I mean, that's just two people. When we see this kind of money that goes into just into one small thing. I mean, this election, just alone, this one single election and the future ones to come. I mean, what does that mean if when they lose? I mean, do you see – I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything like that, but when there's that kind of money on the line, I mean, these aren't dumb people who are, like, putting a lot of money into one basket here. If that doesn't happen, I mean –
What it means is that we are becoming an oligarchy rather than a democracy. An oligarchy is a form of government that is run by the wealthy, by and for the wealthy. And we are already largely there, and this election may well put us, particularly if the Republicans continue to control the legislative agenda and control the Supreme Court, may put us fully there, where we no longer have something that resembles a democratic republic. We have something that looks more like feudal Europe circa 1600 and or 1400. And that's not a direction that I think most of us want to go, but there is a small cadre of very, very wealthy people and transnational corporations that see that very much being into their advantage. Stephen, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Why should any American be embarrassed to call themselves a conservative? I'll tell you at the top of the next hour.
Just another manic Monday.
Indeed. Welcome back. Yes, I had my coffee. You can tell by how fast I'm talking. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, the Senate will vote later today on the Disclose Act.
Yes, we just had Senator Merkley on about that. He was hopeful but not optimistic. I mute my language, not his. Do you have any inside skinny on this?
Not on how the vote is going to go. I think it's going to be close. People have got concerns about re-election and things like that. But certainly no Republican is going to vote for the Disclose Act. And I think pretty much most of the Democrats will vote for it. But, you've got your Nelson and people like that who are likely to vote against.
So there's going to be you think there'll be a successful cloture vote? They're going to allow an actual vote on it, or is it going to be filibustered?
I think it's going to be stopped to cloture. I would be very surprised if it's allowed to move forward beyond that.
So at that point, it doesn't even matter if there's any Democrats who are.
No.
Yeah.
No. So I think it's going to die. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid today warned that if Congress fails to limit campaign donations from the wealthy, he said, if this flood of outside money continues, the day after the election, 17 angry old white men will wake up and realize they just bought the country.
Yeah, he's right.
He's getting very outspoken.
Yeah. Well, he's seen which way the wind blows. I mean, this is the outcome of Citizens United and a lot of other things that preceded it. I mean, it wasn't a singular event, but it was the capstone. And if Congress can't do something, Samuel Alito? No, wait a minute. It wasn't Alito. It was Scalia. Anthony Scalia's concurring opinion in Citizens United came right out and said, you know, if you guys don't like the fact that we're letting corporations and billionaires buy the elections, then simply pass a very simple law that says they have to disclose who they are. And all the Republicans said, see, everything's fine, but not so much. Oh, well. So what else is going on?
Well, the word seems to be getting around that Mitt Romney might announce his vice presidential pick this week, partly because it's a good time to do it, because we've got the Olympics, he's traveling, he's got to fit it in. Also partly to change the conversation from when he left Bain Capital.
Right.
Tim Pawlenty's name is now being bandied about as up there along with Rob Portman.
Hmm.
So he's considered really somebody who has been on the stump for Romney and has really been campaigning hard for him,
right,
and that they've formed a good friendship since the primary. And that he, with his working class background, and as an evangelical Christian, brings certain things to the ticket that Romney needs.
Right. And Portman, having been Bush's trade guy, doesn't so much, especially since trade has become an issue with regard to Bain.
It really doesn't bring that much. I mean, he may still go in that direction. It would be a very safe choice, but it's a real snooze choice. Pawlenty is less of a snooze choice.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see, and it's going to be interesting to see if he can change the conversation, because now that it looks like he lied under oath to either the Securities Exchange Commission or the state of Massachusetts right around the time, I mean, just, within a year or two of the time that a sitting president of the United States was impeached for lying under oath, This does not bode well for Mr. Romney.
It doesn't. He may get some help in changing the conversation, particularly among some groups of Americans, by a remark by President Obama over the weekend when he was campaigning. When he was talking on his standard stump speech about how nobody builds a business on their own because we're all in it together. He says this in every speech.
Sure, and every business requires public infrastructure and an educated right. workforce and all that stuff, yeah.
He said it in a way that has been jumped on.
Oh, I know. Go ahead.
Familiar with he said somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you've got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
Right. And that was a bad off the top of his head way of constructing that sentence.
Exactly. And of course, it's being pounced on. The Romney campaign is calling the remark insulting and basically saying that, you know, that they're going after entrepreneurs and small business owners, that the Obama campaign is doing that.
That's nonsense.
So it gives them an opening. You have to be so careful what you say these days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got your politics. But, you know, this also, I think, gives the president an opening to explain what he's talking about.
It does.
You know, it's not like he's trying to hide his tax returns. I mean, he actually, there's some there. I mean, the fact of the matter is, my radio show, this successful business that you're on right now, would not exist if all the people who work here hadn't had good public educations for free, if they couldn't get to work on the metro or through the public roads. If we didn't have the public airwaves on which to broadcast our show, I mean, you could argue that, and in fact, I would argue very, very strongly that without the public commons, without the stuff that we all built together, and with all the people who preceded me, who, you know, from whom I learned and on whose shoulders I stood, that, you know, this show doesn't exist in a vacuum. And that's all Obama was saying.
And he if this real drumbeat, if this goes really viral beyond the right-wing radio shows, which is where it is right now, and of course Fox News, he may have to say something. Initially, I'm sure he'll try to have Jay Carney say something, but he may have to address this.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would just say very briefly is that a former senior Barclays bank executive faced scrutiny in British Parliament today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about his role in the bank's rate manipulation scandal. He indicated that he'd instructed bank employees to report lower rates at the behest of bank regulators.
Oh,
that's what he says. Now, the question is, did he misinterpret an email from the head of the bank, Mr. Diamond, who's also resigned, or was he, in fact, following instructions from Diamond? And the lawmakers hammered away at this really, really hard. They repeatedly asked him whether lowering the bank's LIBOR submissions in line with those of rivals was illegal, improper, and wrongful. And he said it didn't seem an inappropriate action given it was taken from the Bank of England.
Hmm. Remarkable. Well, this story has a long way to play out. So
yes.
We'll keep an eye on this. Victoria Jones, thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
With the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So, I want to talk about conservatism. Okay, conservatism is the political ideology that is being waved around by today's Republican Party, by corporate America, and frankly, even by some Democrats. According to a recent research poll by the Pew Research Center, conservative was the second most positively viewed political term in America, right behind progressive. That's kind of good news. I mean, Republicans love the label so much, their biggest political conference of the year is CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. And I think this year I missed it, but every other year I've been there. And as I recall, we just missed it this year because Louise got sick. But in any case, and we will be back next year. I'm trying to figure out why it is, though, that conservative is the second most beloved word or, you know, political term in America. I mean, I'm trying to figure out why anyone, given our nation's history, would want to call themselves a conservative today in America. They say that conservative means someone who embraces traditional values, limited government, moderate change, and fiscal restraint. But those are just weasel words. They're the velvet glove over the brutal fist of an autocratic, authoritarian, and oligarchic form of governance. Here's the reality of what conservatives have actually done to this nation. I mean, just go back and take a look at our 230-year-plus history. First of all, even before we were a nation, it was conservatives who opposed the American Revolution. Many of them joined the British in fighting against George Washington's army. George Washington, the guy who proudly called himself a liberal and said, "I hope I shall ever see an increase in liberality in America." Then after the conservatives lost that war, literally, conservatives at the birth of our nation pushed to restrict voting rights at the federal level to only white men who own property. Although progressives like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison blocked those federal efforts, so conservatives at the state level picked up that cause. Although free slaves and African Americans could vote in a number of northern states, and women could vote in another number of northern states in the first 20 or 30 years of our republic, by either 1809 or 1819, I forget which it was. It was one or the other. New Jersey was the last state to make it illegal for women to vote. And reasonably within that time period, all the northern states had stopped allowing African Americans to vote as well. It was conservatives who wanted to keep the traditional American value of slavery and fought progressive Abraham Lincoln so fiercely that it led to a bloody and horrific civil war. And in the aftermath of that civil war, conservatives supported the Jim Crow laws to keep freed slaves as second-class citizens. Conservatives opposed women's suffrage, the right to vote, all the way up until the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920, and some still oppose it to this day. You get Rush Limbaugh going off on this. This is like a conservative mantra, the war on women. It's not just the vote anymore. It's like, you know, you could come along and say, well, women should at least make as much as men in the workplace. What? Wealthy conservative elites have opposed every advancement made by average working people, from the 40-hour work week to child labor laws to workplace safety laws. During the 1950s, conservatives embraced McCarthyism and the witch hunts that ruined the lives of thousands of Americans. In the 1960s, conservatives opposed the Civil Rights Act, which finally ended legal discrimination in America. You see, every single advance our nation has made from our founding, including our founding, came despite conservative efforts to block it. Some of you may be old enough to remember William F. Buckley. He was the conservative, the grandfather, the father of modern American conservatism. And back in the 1960s, he said, "A conservative is someone who stands athwart history yelling stop at a time when no one is inclined to do so." At each turning point in our history to give more rights to more Americans, to give more economic opportunity to more Americans, to make the workplace safer for more Americans, you name it, at every single turn, conservatives have tried to stop it, while progressives have fought, bled, and died to make sure it happens. And today, nothing has changed. Today, the conservatives are yelling, stop, when it comes to marriage equality. They're yelling, stop, when it comes to climate change legislation. They're yelling, stop, when it comes to equal pay for equal work for women. They're yelling stop when it comes to critical life-saving stem cell research. They're yelling stop when it comes to providing health insurance at an affordable cost to all Americans. They're yelling stop when it comes to immigration reform. Conservatives are yelling stop when it comes to ending Nixon's failed drug war. Not only are they yelling stop, but they're actively trying to undo most of the progressive victories over the last century. I mean, all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt, 1907. Republican Teddy Roosevelt was president. The Tillman Act, that made it a felony for corporations to support politicians. They're trying to undo everything. Everything. The war against women, forcing women to submit to mandatory ultrasounds like their children are wards of the state. It includes passing more and more right-to-work-for-less laws, further eroding the rights of working people in America. It includes gutting food safety programs, unemployment benefits, and food stamps. It even includes sabotaging our economic recovery so that they can achieve their ultimate political goal, which is kicking that black guy out of the White House. This is what conservatism has been all about in America and continues to be about: fear, discrimination, and corporate domination. The conservative principles of limited government and more freedom might sound good, but in practice, what it really means is less government to protect you and me, to protect Americans from corporate abuses, and more freedom for people like the Koch brothers to pollute. It means less government to provide social services and more freedom to die like a dog in the gutter without health insurance. That's been the message of the conservative movement since the founding of our nation, always wanting to take us backward when always we should be moving forward. So, the question. I don't get it. Just, you know, very simple question. Why would anyone proudly call themselves a conservative? I mean, I get these people who call into the program and they go, "Oh, yeah, I'm a conservative and I want to talk to you about..." I'm like, well, really? You're a conservative? What does that mean?
I'm opposed to higher taxes.
Oh, really? On billionaires? Or on yourself? Or what? You know, you're opposed to, like, funding the fire department? I mean, I get it when people say, you know, I don't like the military industrial complex, and I don't want to pay the taxes for, you know, bombs that get dropped on other people or drones or whatever. I'm actually with you on that. But oddly, that's not a conservative position today. It would have been in the 1950s. That was Dwight Eisenhower's position. You know, one modern destroyer is 80,000 bushels of wheat. It's 6,000 homes that could be built, you know, for middle-income families. I mean, you know, Dwight Eisenhower laid it out. But that's not conservative anymore. Conservative now means, hey, somebody can make a buck in the military-industrial complex. If a defense contractor can make billions with no big contracts because you got a war going on, hey, conservatives are all for it. What conservative means today is oligarchy. What conservative means today is the and not all billionaires, obviously, but the billionaire and multimillionaire groups that are working to seize America from our being a democratic republic.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And they've been given the tools to do it by five conservatives on the Supreme Court. You really want to call yourself a conservative? Oh, release me, please, Mitt Romney. I'm just a tax return. I want to be out there. Well, you know, Romney did share 20 years worth of tax returns with John McCain. What did John McCain do? Said, I think I'll pick Sarah Palin. At least that's what the record seems to show. I mean, you know, I wasn't in the room, so. But Dan in Stockton, California. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, Tom. I totally go along with what you just said about American conservative history. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to point out is, historically speaking, the enemies of America have been conservative.
Yeah, that's right. Sweden has never attacked America.
Yeah, Kaiser Wilhelm, Hitler, Hirohito.
Yeah.
The Ayatollahs.
Yeah, and I would argue that by the time Stalin was done with the Soviet Union, it was no longer leftist, and the same with Mao in China. They had become functionally dictatorships.
Stalin never was a socialist. He was a fascist all the way.
Yeah.
He killed more people than Hitler did.
He just never used that word. But, yeah, actually, he wasn't technically a fascist because fascists want the merging of corporate and state, and Stalin simply ended all the corporations and said, it is the state. But the point is that was not the left. That is not the left. That, you know, what Stalin was building was not Sweden. And, you know, good point. The United States has never been attacked by the left, as it were. And even France, you know, which became very left after the French Revolution, I was going to say, you know, they helped fund the American Revolution, too. But that, I don't know if that's got a left-right axis. That was more King Louis hating King George. So, but excellent point. Thank you very much, and thank you for calling and making it. I appreciate the call. Let's see. Mary in Chicago. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to address something that the last guest that you had on was saying about a lot of the money that was paid back went to the Treasury.
What he said was that a lot of the money that we borrowed was a lot of the debt that we issued was bought by the Fed. I think he said 60%. I can't verify that number.
Right. And you said good.
Yes, I did.
And he said, but an individual can never do that or
right.
would be thrown in jail. But it made me think that I currently have a loan from my 401k, which I'm paying back to myself with interest.
Excellent point. You are doing exactly what he said an individual couldn't do, and he's
and
wrong.
And why would I borrow from anyone else
when you can borrow from yourself?
Interest.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent point, Mary.
So, okay.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. That was a great one. That was a really great one. Jim in Hillsville, Washington. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, good afternoon. I wanted to point something out about the Mormons. My daughter and of course, my son-in-law are Mormons. Mm-hmm. And one day, my daughter was at our food bank. My wife and I run the food bank at the Episcopal Church in Longview. And she said, well, who do you help here? And my wife said, we help anyone. We don't care, black, white, care if you're even a communist. We'll help you if you're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And our daughter replied, well, they have to join our church for to get help. And they have a big store in Portland on Southeast 82nd, which I'm sure you know about, the Deseret store.
Actually, I didn't know about that.
No. Yeah, you can get incredible stuff there. I mean, it's top drawer stuff, but you got to be a Mormon.
That's probably why I didn't know about it. I'm not a Mormon, so.
Yeah, it's terrible.
So there's a store in Portland, Oregon, where you can only go shopping there if you're a Mormon, really?
If you're a Mormon, you can shop there. And if you are needy, you know, you don't have grocery money or something, you can go there and they have beautiful meat and vegetables and you name it.
Yeah.
And I you know, that's terrible.
Well, it seems to me that there would be an element of legal discrimination there, but maybe it's, you know, one of these membership clubs, you know, like Sam's Club kind of thing, where you've got to basically become a member, and their membership is to become a Mormon. I don't know. I can't speak to it. But
all our daughter said, well, you have to be a Mormon before we can help you in that store.
Yeah. Well,
that's not right.
If that's the case, Jim, I agree with you. That's not right. Thank you for the call. Cora in Calles, New Mexico. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Well, I was just going to speak again about Citizens United and, you know, this premise that supposedly we have the right to hear what other people say, but when they're anonymous, it's just like reading graffiti on the wall or, you know, anonymous poison pen letters, because even the newspapers will not publish a letter to the editor unless you sign it and put your name and address on it.
Right. That's an excellent point.
I don't understand how, you know, we can make a decision on something that we don't know who it is, you know, like somebody who doesn't believe in science.
Right.
You know, so I don't know how they can get away with that.
Well, they're making the argument that putting hundreds of millions of dollars into creating phony front groups that don't have their name on them, you know, Citizens for a Better Tomorrow, if I ask Stephen Colbert's, but you get my point, you know, creating these phony front groups and so that they can conceal their identity and then running ads that trash politicians, typically Democratic politicians or Greens or whatever, that somehow they are exercising...
Yeah, right. But like I said, you know, if you, you can't make a decision, you know, depending on when you don't know who's speaking.
I agree with you. I think that an important part of having information is knowing the source of that information. And I would ask the question of every Republican senator. And if you go to callcongress.org, there's the toll-free numbers that you can call the, you know, the switchboard here in Washington, D.C. to get through to Congress and simply ask for your senator if you have a Republican senator. And if not, ask for one of the, you know, the leading Republican senators and ask the simple question, why is it that you don't want the source of these political of this political speech to be known? Because it seems to me that knowing the source of it should be part of the information. It absolutely should be part of the information. Cora, thank you. Very, very well said. Spot on. And thanks for listening to KVOT. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. It's our Please Release Me Day in memory of Mitt Romney's tax returns.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, and Mick Silver in our chat room has a link to Bernie's over at sanders.senate.gov, Bernie's rant on disclosing corporate cash. It's great. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very rubiginously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good. Gift Cap Pledge Alliance. The Georgia group with both Tea Party and progressive members is fighting to tighten Georgia's lobbying rules, which currently allow lobbyists to give unlimited gifts to state lawmakers. The group has been pushing a statewide effort to limit lobbyist gifts to $100 or less. And nearly 200 state lawmakers have already signed on to support the new proposed gift limits. And members of both parties in Georgia have agreed to place a non-binding question on ending the current lobbying practices on their primary ballots. It seems Georgia is trying to reel in the lobbyists and their corrupt influence on our democracy. Frankly, it's time Washington did the same thing. The bad. Mississippi Agriculture and Forestry Museum. The museum recently denied Kara Sturgis and Emily Kay, a lesbian couple, from having a commitment ceremony at their facilities. While the museum allows heterosexual couples to have weddings and other ceremonies, it says that it has a policy banning same-sex weddings and ceremonies. And in 2009, the museum was told by state officials that it could limit the use of its facilities to events that are legal under state law. This would suggest the museum thinks same-sex marriages are illegal in Mississippi, which they are not. The museum and the state have basically said the same-sex commitment ceremonies are illegal. That is a disgusting attack on the personal liberties and freedoms of the LGBT community. And the very, very ugly, the Florida Supreme Court. On Thursday, the court upheld a controversial drug possession law in that state, which essentially moves the burden of proof from the state to the defendant. This means that anyone charged with a drug crime in Florida, no matter how small a crime may be, will have to prove that they did not know they were carrying drugs on them at the time of the arrest. Florida Supreme Court ruled that law was constitutional after it was struck down by a U.S. federal district court. So not only is Florida continuing America's epic failure of Nixon's drug war, but the state is also trashing one of the key notions of our justice system, that someone's innocent until proven guilty. And that is very, very ugly. That is mind-bogglingly ugly. Dan, in Stowe, Vermont, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Great. So listen to your show all the time, and I appreciate your sort of your thoughtfulness, so I wanted to ask you this question, which is how does the Republican Party, how have they been so successful in convincing people that don't benefit from their policies to continue to vote for them? I have conversations on a regular basis with people that that just don't seem to, they don't get the big picture and they don't benefit from the policies, but they continue to vote Republican.
Right.
So I'll take the answer out there, but I just don't understand it.
Well, I can tell you very, very simply, there's two ways that they do it. One, with regard to economic policies, they simply lie. You know, Obamacare is the biggest tech. In fact, there's a great piece in the New York Times today about the five biggest lies. Bill Keller wrote this, the five Obamacare myths. Obamacare is a job killer. Turns out, fact factcheck.org says that's a whopper, bogus, and hooey. Obamacare is a federal takeover of health insurance. He says, let's be blunt, the word for that is lie. And then, you know, they go on to Obamacare is a loser, run against it. Well, actually, it's going to work out well. But so number one, they lie about economic issues. But more importantly, what they do is they reach out to people's fears. Look out for those brown people. They're going to come and get your job. Look out for those black people. They're going to come after, you know, fill in the blank. Look out for those gay people. You know, it's always look out. You know, look out for the communists. They're going to come and get you. Look out for the and they play on people's fears. Look out for the government. They're going to come and take your guns. It's always about be afraid, be afraid. And every election cycle, they've got a new thing to be afraid of. Although there tend to be themes to those fears, which is basically homophobia and racism and anti-Semitism and things like that. But that's basically it. It's really boils down to really simple stuff. Makes sense?
How do you convince someone that is, an educated person that you work with on a day-to-day basis, works in a professional environment, how do you convince someone like that of that? I mean, they don't seem to be driven by these underlying fears, but you're probably right. So how do you convince them? What would be an argument that you can make an educated professional way to dispute this?
The only way that I've found that is successful, and it's interesting the number of conservatives over the years who call into this program to debate with me and then ultimately end up being on our side, as it were, is to take it policy by policy, issue by issue, and just say, let's try to find the truth here. Let's try to find out what is really true. Because, you know, historically there have been times when the Republican Party was on the right, you know, I mean, and I mean the correct, you know, it's like Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. They were progressives. They were doing the right thing. I can't say that of the modern Republican Party, but there have been times when Republicans have, and Dwight Eisenhower was a Republican. And you know, by today's standards, he was a largely a progressive. So I would just say, okay, what is it that concerns you? Oh, well, I don't want my taxes to go up. Well, did you know that Obama has cut taxes on people who make under $250,000 18 times since he became president? No, I didn't know that. I didn't hear that on Fox News. Well, of course you're not going to hear that on Fox News. You know?
Yeah.
You know, or I know that Obama's going to raise my taxes. Well, you make more than $250,000? Yeah, he probably will. Well, I don't make more than $250,000. Or if they say, yeah, I make over $250,000, you say, well, then, you know, I don't have a problem with your taxes going up 3%. I don't think it's going to kill you. And, you know, I mean, just you take it issue by issue. Obamacare is going to be a terrible thing. Well, what's terrible about decoupling health care from your employer? I mean, you know, there's a lot of people who are stuck in dead-end jobs just because they don't want to lose their health insurance. Wouldn't it unleash a wave of entrepreneurialism if all across America, everybody all of a sudden realized that they could still have health care and they didn't have to have the employer they have? They could go out and start their own business without worrying that, you know, if they happen to get sick in the midst of it or there's some kind of crisis happens in their family, they get in a car accident, that they're going to be toast? I mean, you know, and these are just, you know, small examples, but issue by issue. And there are some issues that, you know, Democrats will lose on. I mean, you know, although the Republicans are not pushing back on those issues. For example, the National Defense Authorization Act or, you know, use of drones to kill people. I mean, unfortunately, the Republicans and Democrats are on the same side on those things. I think that there should be some difference. Or international trade. You know, increasingly the Democratic Party is moving in the direction of saying free trade is a stupid thing. But for the last 30 years, the Democratic Party has been wholly in that bed with the Republicans, you know, ever since the Clinton, George Herbert Walker Bush debates in 92. And Ross Perot was standing on the side saying, stop, guys, stop, you know, giant sucking sound from the South and all that kind of stuff. So there are times, you know, I'm not a total partisan. I'm a progressive, first and foremost. And I think that the Democratic Party at the moment is to some extent serving the interests of progressive causes, in some ways is not. But I really think that, and I think that it's more important for us to build a grassroots national movement that's based in progressive values than it is to build party politics. That said, the Supreme Court's on the line in this election, and the ability to eventually say no to the Supreme Court and Citizens United is on the line in this election. So, you know, it's a high stakes election. But I hope I've answered your question, Dan. Thank you very much for the call. Linda in Portland. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Yes, I just wanted to correct the caller that talked about the Mormons only supplying their members with welfare project or welfare help.
Mm-hmm. Well, the basis of his information was his daughter.
I've been helping to give the program to the needy people
mm-hmm.
for 5 years, and he is all wrong on it. The thrift store is open to anyone. They can come in and buy. If they have a special need that a bishop has signed, they can get it for free. The food is not at, no one buys the food. It is only for people with the bishop's order. Of course, mostly Mormons know the bishops, but anyone can go to a Mormon bishop, explain their needs, and get a slip that will allow them to go there and take food home.
But it sounds like you're describing is a system where before I can go into the thrift store and get things free or highly discounted, I first have to go to the church.
You have to talk to the bishop in order to get them free.
Right.
It's like any other thrift store if you're going in to pay money for them. But no, you do not have to talk to a bishop to shop at that store.
Okay. I absolutely, Linda, that's marvelous, and thank you for setting the record straight. And I totally defend the Mormon Church or any other church's, right to say, we're going to do it this way, and you've got to jump through this hoop to get something for free. And on the other hand, the things that people pay for, if it's run like a traditional Salvation Army store, you don't have to join the Salvation Army, which is an evangelical Christian church. You don't have to join the Salvation Army to shop at the Salvation Army stores. I can tell you that from having probably shopped in at least 100 of them when I was a kid. On the weekends, my parents used to travel all over Michigan and visit Salvation Army stores. But on the other hand, it seems a little cloistered to say if you're in need, you have to see to a bishop rather than you have to see a social worker.
Well, the bishop is where the order is signed. He has to sign the order form for you to pick up food. But could I just add one more thing to let you know about me? I'm a lifelong Mormon, a lifelong Democrat, an Obama fan from the beginning. Do not assume that all Mormons are Romney fans. They are not.
Okay. Thank you very much, Linda. Thank you for a kinder, gentler take on the Mormon Church. Great to hear from you. Thank you. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, once again, when is Mitt Romney going to release his tax returns? Oh, who's he going to elect for or put on the ticket for vice president? Let's change the topic, right? Indeed. Victoria, watching on DirecTV on Free Speech TV Network. Hey, Victoria, what's up in Sun Lake, Arizona? What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I am calling about the Disclose Act because I strongly support that. And I'm not clear about whether they voted on it yet or not, but I called my representatives in Congress, and I just wanted to tell you what they said.
Okay.
John McCain's office was the best. They said that they had no official statement and no official position. So I told him my position and urged him to support it. And I would encourage other people to call him.
Well, given that he was the co-author of McCain-Feingold, I would...
And I also called Representative Flake's office, and they wouldn't even tell me what their position was.
Right.
I directed him, as my representative in Congress, to support the Disclose Act.
Uh-huh.
And then I called John Kyle's office, and they had an official statement, which they read to me against it.
Right.
And so I directed him, as my representative in Congress, to change his position and support it.
Huh, good. Good on you. Thank you for making those phone calls.
Do you think it's too late for people to still call? Because if it's not too late, I would suggest that they call McCain.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if the vote has already been taken, it's not too late, because this topic will get revisited, and people do need to know that there is a grassroots uprising about this, and that people are concerned about it. And, you know, it may be months, maybe even years before it, you know, this issue really gets laid to rest. But we need to be continuously speaking out, and you did a great job, Victoria. Thank you so much for the call, and thanks for what you did. Oh, this is interesting. Rob in Logan, Utah, you wanted to explain the Mormon food banks. I'm just learning about this. I find it fascinating. Tell me about it.
Who are you talking to me?
I am. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. First of all, what I would like to say is this, is when you talk about Mormons, everybody associates Mormons with Salt Lake City.
Right.
You have different splinter groups. You got fundamentalists, reorganized, stuff like that. They're not part of the church in Salt Lake.
Okay.
Now, the proper term is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Right.
Now, about this food that they're talking about, first of all that food is produced by the LDS Church. They have farms, they have ranches, stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
that is raised by volunteers.
Okay.
Nobody in a church gets paid, from the president of the church down.
Okay.
That's all either elected or volunteer work. Now,
good.
They have canneries. If you come north of Salt Lake, you'll, on alongside of 15, you'll see large silos, flour mills. Now, they do help people that are down and out, and they don't have to be Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be. If you see the black trucks, anytime there's a disaster, the Mormon church is there, and they don't care who you are. They will help you out.
Sure.
They don't care about what religion you belong to. You need help. They'll give it to you.
Mm-hmm.
But the products that are in those stores are bishop's storehouses.
Mm-hmm.
And the products in there is all raised, and it's processed by the LDS Church. And mm-hmm. like the lady says, you have to go to the bishop, and they have a form, A to Z, that lists all the products. And you just mark the spot, how many you want, and there's no charge. There's no cash registers in that store.
Hmm.
And they'll even help you load it in the carts. They'll even put it in your vehicle. They don't ask your religion or nothing.
That's great.
You see, but they have that list.
But the bishop is not at the store, right? You've got to go to a church to get the bishop to sign off on it.
Right. But the best thing to do is people talk about the LDS Church, and most of them are from hearsay. I said, why don't you just grab a handle, open a door, go in,
mm-hmm.
go for a couple of weeks, ask questions. Be a spy. Come in and find out what the Mormon church is all about. We're no different than most Protestant churches.
I don't disagree.
That's it.
I would say, you know, in my opinion, every church has, you know, a lot of positive aspects, community, fraternity, those kinds of things, and some wackadoodle beliefs that they have that you know, make them unique from other churches. And they say, no, those people are the wackadoodle ones. We're not. And you know, I'm all in favor of everybody having their own beliefs and doing however they want to do it, as long as they're not asking me to pay their taxes. That's the one place where you and I may disagree, Rob. But thank you for clarifying the information on the Mormon Church, and I appreciate it. You're a very good spokesperson for your religion. Lane in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Lane, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just very quickly, here in Eugene, there's at least 5 denominations I can think of, religious organizations, that have either food banks or thrift stores, and they give vouchers to poor people. And you have to go to their church office,
to get them.
The organization office, to get a voucher to go to the store and pick up the bicycles or
sure.
for people that need to get to work, clothing,
yeah.
et cetera. Furniture, all those things are available at these different congregations. But yeah,
I would submit to you, Lane, that is not the kind of giving that Jesus talked about in the Sermon on the Mount. In the Sermon on the Mount, he went out of his way to say that, you know, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing when it's doing good works. And to say, we're going to do good works, but only if you jump through this hoop first, smacks to me of a form of evangelism that's far more secular than was preached
no.
by.
No, I disagree. There is no evangelism at all. You just have to sign that you meet the federal guidelines. A lot of this stuff is donated. You sure. don't have to do anything. Go to an office and say that you're poor and certify that
no,
you're
I,
poor.
I got it, Lane, and I realize that there have to be some sort of systems and procedures. Maybe we could take this theological debate a layer deeper another time, but we're out of time now. Thanks for listening to KPOJ, though, Lane, and thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, when did Mitt Romney actually leave Bain, and does it matter? Matthew Vadim of Capital Research is going to be here. It's going to be a debate, and plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It's not a spectator sport. So tag your it. Get out there, get active,
You've
occupy
been
something.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.